no return when you're entering into a formal agreement. Many of you know this. There's a line that once crossed becomes very, very difficult to backtrack. Anyone who's ever entered into a lease knows this. There are final signatures involved. Same with any kind of major purchase or enlisting in the military. Sign the dotted line is an expression for a reason. At that point, you're committed. And people operate largely in terms of contracts, in terms of agreements, and in words that have meaning and in formality, signed statements, notaries, wills, and testimonies. All these things have to do with formalizing relationships and decisions in a binding way. In a binding way. People have always functioned this way. I'm reading a lot just on the side. I'm reading a lot about the Viking Age right now because it's interesting. And if you swear your allegiance to a regional chief in Scandinavia in 900 AD and you receive his distinctive mark or armband, you're his. That's binding. You have an obligation now. You've crossed that threshold. There are rules you've got to follow. Crossing that line is a big deal. This is why in the news, you see footage often whenever the president signs a bill. There's always a photo of or a video clip of that moment that the bill is signed. This is why there are witnesses present when a man and wife sign their marriage license. Contracts are binding. That's their very nature. Today we're in Exodus 24. Israel has been formed as a nation. They've been saved out of slavery. They've been preserved in the wilderness. They've been brought to the mountain. And they've received the law. And now, God gets down to business with them. Shall we make things official? In Exodus 24, the covenant is confirmed between God and this small, yet to be known, nation called Israel. They enter into a formal covenantal relationship. That's Exodus 24. And this is so much more than simply a blip on the world history radar. This is more than just a neat occasion or a landmark moment in Israel's own history. Today, for us, church, we will see God is a God of covenant, big picture wise. God is a God of covenant. We will see that God is the God who enters into real, intimate, intentional relationship with his creatures. That's the nature of our God. Today, my hope is that we see God as glorious, specifically in the respect that he is a God of covenants. This is good news, not just for Israel back then. This is very good news for us today. We have great reason to be glad and joyful and secure because our God is a God of covenant specifically. So here's a proposition for you today. It is this: for sinful people to be in fellowship with God, a covenant must be kept. For sinful people to be in fellowship with God, a covenant must be kept. I know that filling out paperwork when you are buying a car or entering a lease can seem tedious. It can seem very boring. Usually it is. Do not have that conception in mind today. There's nothing boring about Exodus 24. God is not simply through going through a formality like a car salesman might. That is not what we're looking at today. The confirmation of the covenant is an amazing event, and that's not even a strong enough word. It is a wonderful sight, and the implications for us are deep. So, let's consider this covenant being confirmed together. I have 3 points for you today. The first is this: the goal of the covenant is worship. I'm going to read to you just the first two verses, and I ask you again, one more time, out of honor for God's word, to please stand with me. Exodus chapter 24, verses 1 and 2 read like this: Then he being God, said to Moses, Come up to the Lord, you and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel, and worship from afar. Moses alone shall come near to the Lord, but the others shall not come near, and the people shall not come up with him. May God bless the reading and the hearing of his holy word. You may have a seat. The goal of the covenant, the point of the covenant, ultimately is worship, worship of God. Moses and Israel are entering into this formal relationship with God. Now, first of all, if you're wondering why I say that that's the point, let me put your mind at ease, because you might be thinking, I did not see the word covenant anywhere in verses 1 and 2, and that's true enough. Why are we talking about a covenant? Look further down with me at verses 7 and 8. They say this: "Then he took the book of the covenant and read it in the hearing of the people, and they said, 'All the Lord has spoken, we will do, and we will be obedient.' And Moses took the blood and threw it on the people and said, 'Behold, the blood of the covenant that the Lord has made with you in accordance with all these words.'" Okay. That's where things are going. We'll get to throwing blood on people in just a little bit. We'll get there. But all of what we are covering today is geared toward formalizing this agreement, this covenant. And the point of the covenant is worship. And it always has been. The point of covenant with God has always been worship. This is not necessarily a new idea. Throughout the early chapters of Exodus, you remember, God is saving a people. Why? That they might worship him. That they might serve him. "Let my people go so that they can hold a feast to me in the wilderness. So that they can serve me." If you remember when Israel first arrived at the mountain back in chapter 19, God says this: "Now therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, you shall be my treasured possession among all peoples. For all the earth is mine. And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words that you shall speak to the people of Israel if you obey my voice and keep my covenant." The goal of covenant is that God have a people who are loyal to him and who desire to worship him. Here's an obvious question that is begged: what is a covenant? Because that might be slightly lost on us. Very, very simply, it's an agreement. It's a compact. It's a confederacy. The word actually is very close to the word to cut, because the common practice, and if you remember Genesis 15, the common practice was to cut an animal or animals in half and walk between the pieces of the animals to formalize the commitment. And more on that later. Keep that in mind. It is an oath. A deep contract. And while covenants could have different goals in mind, whether property boundaries or marriage commitments, this covenant was geared toward worshiping God. So let me state the goal of this covenant in a bit stronger terms. This covenant exists so that people who, because of sin, have no right or ability of their own to worship God might do so. It's an extremely generous allowance. People who have no business engaging God might be able to. That's the point of this covenant. And we'll see that fleshed out in a bit. But let's just stay here for a moment. And here we may really begin marveling at our God. God in heaven provided a covenant so that rebellious people can be near him in worship. This is profound. And it is seemingly problematic, isn't it? Remember, the very point of humanity, never mind just Israel, the very point of humanity was to worship God. Our marching orders in Genesis 1 were to fill the earth with the image of God, accurately representing him in all that we say and do. But all people in general, and this young nation specifically, had been rebellious, had they not? Remember their grumbling not long ago? Remember their longing to be back in Egypt? Remember their turning against Moses in rebellion? By all rights, because of their sin, they ought to remain distant from God. And yet, God creates a covenant that they might draw near to him in worship. So the covenant then allows people to do the right thing. The covenant allows people to do what they were made to do, to give worship where it is due, to fulfill the great human purpose of giving praise and glory to the only one who deserves it. You may not see why a covenant is necessary for worship of God, but I think we will continue to get there, so just hang with me. But remember, Israel here is responding to God and not the other way around. The covenant is coming to them not on their terms, but on God's terms. He desires worship, and a covenant is the path to get there. This is the foundation that must be in place for sinful people to worship Him. If you've ever found yourself in any kind of helpless state, you've experienced that when you cannot help yourself, you can only move forward on someone else's terms. Accept help and provision as they determine and dictate. That's what's going on here. These Israelites are at the mountain because God brought them to the mountain. If they're going to worship God, it will be on His terms. The covenant makes a way for this. So I don't want to save this until the end. This is not simply a history lesson, because the same God operates in terms of covenant today. He does. This was not an experiment that He tried and then abandoned. Christian, if you are His child today, you are under what Scripture calls the new covenant. Same word. You are under the new covenant, and the new covenant is better than the old. That's what Scripture says. But the old points to and prepares us for the new. We'll see that more clearly as we go on as well. But I want to plant this in your mind now. God is still a God of covenant, and that means a lot for people who are on the receiving end. We are on the dependent end of the covenant. And the point of covenant today is still worship. Just like then, the point today is still worship. It has not changed for us. Philippians says that if we are Christians, then God lives in us, that we might will and work for His good pleasure. That's worship. So we'll get to the details about how this covenant is sealed and more fully what it means. But at this point, please just hear this. If you tend to relegate the story of Exodus and Mount Sinai, if in your mind you simply assign that, oh, that's an ancient historical narrative and nothing more, if it is nothing more than that in your mind, please hear this. God still, today, invites people into relationship with Him. This has not changed. God still invites people into relationship with Him. He sets out terms for how this is to happen, not us. God in heaven beckons us into a meaningful relationship with our Creator. That is the point of covenant. Everyone here today is either under that new covenant as a child of God, or they're not. So, let's learn more about it. The point of covenant is worship. And second point, the seal of the covenant is blood. And this is where we get into the interesting stuff. The seal of the covenant is blood. Let me read to you verses 3 through 8. Moses came and told the people all the words of the Lord and all the rules. And all the people answered with one voice and said, "All the words that the Lord has spoken, we will do." And Moses wrote down all the words of the Lord. He rose early in the morning and built an altar at the foot of the mountain and 12 pillars according to the 12 tribes of Israel. And he sent young men of the people of Israel who offered burnt offerings and sacrificed peace offerings of oxen to the Lord. And Moses took half of the blood and put it in basins. And half of the blood he threw against the altar. Then he took the book of the covenant and he read it in the hearing of the people. And they said, "All that the Lord has spoken, we will do and we will be obedient." And Moses took the blood and threw it on the people and said, "Behold, the blood of the covenant that the Lord has made with you in accordance with all these words." Okay, let's make sure we understand what is happening here. God has given Moses the Ten Commandments. You remember, we spent a long time there. I'm not going to sing. God gave Moses the Ten Commandments, and He has given him what is called the Book of the Covenant. If you remember, that's the application of the law, chapters 21, 22, and 23. So the Ten Commandments and how to obey them, basically. The Book of the Covenant. Moses has it. God says that the goal of all of this is that he might be worshipped. And then like a mediator going between two parties, Moses now goes back to the people. He catches them up on what God has said. He clarifies the terms of the covenant to the people on God's behalf. He came down and he told the people all the words, all the rules. He's reciting it again. It took a while. Listen, God will enter into covenant with you, Israel, but here is specifically what he requires. And he basically, in our terms, rereads and recites chapters 20 through 23 of Exodus to them. So, I've got to say, I love the nation of Israel's optimism at this point. Because there's a lot there in terms of their obligation on their part. There's a lot to obey. A lot to obey. And not to spoil much, but if you don't know the story, they don't. In fact, the covenant is not yet completely affirmed before they enter into gross idolatry. How do they respond, though? All the people answered with one voice and said, "All the words that the Lord has spoken, we will do." And at this point, we have a verbal commitment, right? This is kind of like the moment of what's called consent in a marriage ceremony. Billy Bob, will you have Susie Q as your wife? Yes, I will. Okay, then we can move forward with the ceremony. They've given verbal consent. Israel has promised obedience. Keep that in mind as we move forward. But with a verbal affirmation, Moses enters into this ceremony of sorts that really requires some study and explanation, because otherwise it sounds rather odd. It's a ritual, you could say, and that would be accurate. It's a process to make formal what has just been promised verbally. He got up in the next morning and he built an altar. We just received instructions for how to build an altar, if you remember. He built an altar where sacrifice could be made, and he built 12 pillars according to the 12 tribes of Israel. The altar and the pillars stood for the parties represented. The altar of sacrifice to God, the pillars representing the 12 tribes of Israel, the people, both parties in the covenant. And then the sacrifices started. Burnt offerings, plural. Peace offerings, plural. Multiple offerings, apparently. I don't know how long this went on. The smell of burnt meat is filling the area. The people are no doubt filled with anticipation about their relationship with God going to a new level. This is a big day. I don't know how long this all went on, but we know that it was long enough that Moses needed multiple basins to catch all the blood from all the slaughtered animals. Why are you saving the blood, Moses? Well, he needs it for an important part of the ceremony. Half of it is thrown on the altar. So with the altar now dripping with the blood of oxen, Moses, who is certainly a little bloodstained himself at this point, he rereads one more time all the words of God. Are you sure? The Ten Commandments and the Book of the Covenant. This is the do or die moment. This is the threshold. And in verses 7 and 8, like I already read, Israel committed, "We will obey. We will keep the Lord's words." And Moses took the blood and he threw it on the people. What is going on here? We hear stuff like this and we may think of a cultic ritual in some primitive place. Blood sacrifice, throwing blood on people. Well, the seal of the covenant is blood. We have to understand this. To solidify, to codify this relationship, there is a meaningful and formal process of making it official, and it requires sacrifice, and it requires commitment from both parties. Maybe this is helpful. Let's jump back in time a bit. If you remember Genesis 15, it involves Abram at the time. It involves Abram. God had Abram look at the stars, good object lesson, and he told him, "Your offspring will be like that." Now, we understand that wonderfully fulfilled through Christ and his work, and according to Galatians. Your offspring will be as numerous as the stars of heaven. And God entered into a covenant with Abram to seal that promise. And if you remember, the covenant was sealed with blood. Abram rounded up some animals, he cut them in half, forming a path in between them, and normally both parties would pass between the carcasses. And the meaning of this was, may the same fate reach me if I break the covenant. May I be like one of these animals, sealed with blood. In Genesis 9, even further back, Noah comes off the ark and God makes a covenant at that point as well. And in fact, that's the first place we see the word covenant used. He says, the earth will endure, I will not flood it again. And at this covenant moment, what was involved? Again, a blood sacrifice. So the covenant with Israel at Sinai is also sealed with blood. Now, there were a lot of people. I don't know how Moses got the blood on all of them, but I don't think he tossed a single bucket out and called it good. I imagine it took some time. Maybe there was a line that passed by him or some other systematized way. We don't know. What we do know is that the covenant is being made official in this moment. That this is no ordinary blood. Moses calls it is the blood of the covenant. So, if you are thinking in a redemptive, historical way, you already know where this is going. New covenant members, Christians, what does this have to do with us? Where is the continuity between the covenants? Because we don't practice anything like that today. If you are wondering what this seemingly odd scene at Mount Sinai in Exodus 24 has to do with Christians today, I commend to you the entire book of Hebrews in our New Testament. It is largely about this topic. The principle is still the same today. We can affirm that. The new covenant, just like the old, is also sealed with blood. It is. They are the same in that way, but they are also different. The blood of the new covenant is better. It is better. Hebrews 9, verses 11 through 15 tells us this. When Christ appeared is a high priest of the good things that have come. The things that Exodus anticipated. The good things have come. Then through the greater and more perfect tent, not made with hands, that is not of this creation, he entered once for all into the holy places, not by means of the blood of goats and calves, but by means of his own blood, thus securing an eternal redemption. Those two words together should floor us. Eternal redemption. For if the blood of goats and bulls and the sprinkling of defiled persons with the ashes of a heifer sanctify for the purification of the flesh, how much more will the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without blemish to God, purify our conscience from dead works to serve the living God? Therefore, he is the mediator of a new covenant, so that those who are called may receive the promised eternal inheritance, since a death has occurred that redeems them from the transgressions committed under the first covenant. So Christians, I said this not long ago, we are not done with the sacrificial system. Not really. Ours is just better than Israel's was, because the sacrifice made on our behalf is better. And it's one and done. It is eternal. It never needs to be repeated. It will never be replaced. The covenant that believers have with God is sealed with perfect blood. And this is why when Peter writes to his believers in his first letter, he begins by saying this. Just listen. He says, to those who are elect exiles, according to the foreknowledge of God the Father, in the sanctification of the Spirit, for obedience to Jesus Christ and for sprinkling with his blood. For sprinkling with Jesus' blood. May grace and peace be multiplied to you. We are sprinkled with the blood of Jesus under this new covenant. And that is really, really good news for us. We will understand just how good it is for us in our last point in just a moment. But again, for now, hear this. In our own story, I'm speaking to Christians. In our own story, we existed in slavery. We were in slavery to sin, and we had hearts that only disobeyed God. We were brought out of that slavery by a deliverer. We then pass through the waters of baptism and enter into a covenant with God in which we are identified as his people. There are many, many parallels from Israel's Exodus to our own. Many, but there are some differences that we must mention. In fact, a word would be upgrades, not differences. we enter into a covenant with our Creator God through the blood of one whose character was truly spotless. His sacrifice was completely satisfying. It is without error. It has no need for improvement. And that may raise some questions in your mind. Hang on to them. And let's wrap this up together. My last point is that the heart of the covenant is God's goodness. The goal is worship. The seal is the blood. And the heart of the covenant is God's goodness. With the goal articulated and the blood in place, we see one of the most astounding scenes that I'm aware of, that in my opinion. I really think it is one of the most astounding scenes in the Old Testament. This is an unrepeated, amazing moment in human history. Let me read to you verses 9 through 11. This is with the covenant in place now. Then Moses and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel went up, and they saw the God of Israel. They saw the God of Israel. There was under his feet, as it were, a pavement of sapphire stone, like the very heaven for clearness. And he did not lay his hand on the chief men of the people of Israel. They beheld God and ate and drank. The elders approached the mountain and they went up, at least partway, verses 1 and 2 tell us. And remember, God had strict, very strict laws about the mountain. But here, 70 elders representing all of these tribes are going up with Moses, Aaron, and Aaron's sons. A crowd of men welcomed into God's presence. This is amazing. This is amazing. They go up the mountain, and in verse 10, they saw the God of Israel. Whoa! The God who dwells in unapproachable light. The God who said, "None can see me and live." Yeah, that God. The God who created all welcomed these men into his presence. And very quickly, I believe it's worth sharing that the Bible gives us a little bit more insight into what this may have been like. I stress may. But what a moment to marvel. So let's marvel. Here's some insight to what this may have been like. Notice that they are near God. But when Moses, the author, describes what they see, what does he describe? He describes what God is standing on and nothing else. Isn't that interesting? It's like he's describing a glass ceiling. It seems that these men were given a very limited vantage point, a periphery view from beneath. And so I consider Ezekiel chapter 1. Now just consider these parallels. Ezekiel has a vision given by God. He sees amazing things, including some angelic beings and all sorts of stuff going on. But it's all taking place above him. He is looking up to see this. And he says this in Ezekiel chapter 1, verses 26 through 28. Above the expanse, over their heads, there was the likeness of a throne, in appearance like sapphire. And seated above the likeness of a throne was a likeness with a human appearance. And upward from what had the appearance of his waist, I saw, as it were, gleaming metal, like the appearance of fire enclosed all around. And downward from what had the appearance of his waist, I saw, as it were, the appearance of fire. And there was brightness around him, like the appearance of the bow that is in the cloud on the day of rain. So was the appearance of the brightness all around. Such was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord. And when I saw it, I fell on my face, and I heard the voice of one speaking. It seems similar, doesn't it? Something amazing is going on above me right now, and I can only kind of tell you what it's sort of like. It's how amazing it is. These men were in the presence of God, but still limited in their sight, still limited in their comprehension, limited by his glory and their sinfulness. I want us to end today understanding something. This entire prospect of entering into a relationship with the God who made us is based not on any obligation he has to us. It is based solely on his goodness. It is based solely on his goodness. Israel did not deserve their deliverance. They were not owed God preserving them through various hardships in the wilderness. These things were a direct result of God's good desire to have a people obedient to himself. He initiated. He saved. He spoke. He instructed. He raised up Moses to act as a mediator between himself and man. He made the allowance for sacrifice and made himself approachable by a sinful people. God's goodness is on full display here at Sinai. And we often don't think about this scene in terms of goodness. We think in terms of terror. The scene at Sinai is scary and overwhelming. That's true enough. But what is most striking about Sinai is not the thunder, it's not the lightning, it's not the earthquakes, it's not the smoke. It's that God is welcoming lawbreakers into his presence. That's what is most striking about Sinai. In a moment, in verses 12 to the end of the chapter, God brings Moses up the mountain for 40 days. But at this point, these 70 men are not, they're not only near God, they sit and have a meal in his presence. I wonder how much they ate. I wonder if they asked for seconds. And in verse 11, he did not kill them. Well, why does that need to be mentioned? Because, no joke, the more understandable thing to happen would be for a pure and holy God to do away with sinful and rebellious people. That would actually fall in place more. That would make more sense. Oh, well, yeah, they're stained with sin. He's perfect. Why would he share space? That makes more sense. But God did not harm them. A meal is among the most intimate avenues of expressing a close relationship. This is why we do this every community group. And here, God invites this group of men to supper. This is an amazing scene. And it is possible, it's only possible because there's a covenant in place. We sing these words, once your enemy, now seated at your table. We're going to sing that in a little bit during the Lord's Supper. That is the literal reality we see here in Exodus 24. People who have no business being near to God are brought near through the blood of the covenant because God is good, because God is full of mercy towards sinners. And we may be asking, well, wait a minute, what about their sin? What about the golden calf? Well, yes, that's coming, unfortunately. That's coming. That's going to happen. But this amazing moment is right on the heels of the sealing of the covenant. Israel had not yet fallen into corporate sin. The blood was still wet on the altar. They would sin, and egregiously. But for this brief moment, we see a snapshot of what life would be like in a sinless Israel, corporately speaking. Seated in the presence of God, not receiving his wrath. Eating food in the presence of the only being who needs nothing to sustain himself. I found this quote to be helpful from Arthur Pink this week. He said this: Israel's history continued for almost 1,500 years after this memorable occasion. But never again did their elders see God. And never again did they eat and drink in his presence. Sin came in. Their very next act was to break the holy law by making and worshiping a golden calf. And the next time we see them drinking, it is of the waters of judgment. How unspeakably blessed to remember that what Israel enjoyed for a brief season is now ours forever. A way has been opened for us into the very presence of God, and there within the veil, we may commune with him. This was a sweet moment for Israel, far beyond what the people deserved. But we have known God's goodness in a greater way. We have known something sweeter under the new covenant. There would come another time that God would invite the representatives of his people to the table. That would happen again. There wouldn't be flashes of lightning. There'd be no smoke. There'd be no fire on the mountain. There would be no mystery. There'd be no barrier between God and man. There would be bread, and there would be wine. And there would be the hands of a humble carpenter washing the feet of his friends and giving them divine instruction. God would invite sinners to the table again. I'm so glad. Jesus Christ at the Last Supper made an amazing claim, especially in light of Exodus 24. You see, anything that a religious Jew at the time would have ever known is this first covenant, the one made at Sinai, the one that depended upon the obedience of the people for it to be sustained. That's the covenant they knew. And Jesus said, I'm making a new covenant with my people. I'm making a new covenant. This one is better. It is longer lasting. It is more secure. The requirement is still obedience, but our obedience will never do. It is the obedience of Jesus himself that matters for this covenant, 1 Corinthians 1. Is the goal still worship? Oh yes, the goal is still worship. But through this new covenant, God secures his people to be with him for eternity in the new creation, worshiping him forever, Isaiah 25. Well, what about blood? Is it still sealed with blood? Yes, this blood is better. It comes from the only true and pure sacrifice in all of the cosmos, Hebrews chapter 12. You see how God built history to repeat itself through the giving of the old covenant, which made the way and showed us our need for a better new covenant. Let Exodus 24 show you the nature of God and covenants and his desire to have community with people. Let it show you the limitations that we have because of our sin and the need for the blood of another to speak for us. But don't stay there. Look to Jesus, whose body was broken and whose blood was spilled, that we might be in a full, unhindered relationship with our God. Isn't God good? Yeah. Now, where does this leave you personally? I was thinking about various ways this can touch us today. Well, now, first of all, this is an invitation for the enemy of God. This is an invitation. If you are not following God on his terms, if you are living in opposition to him and his law, today, you are invited into the covenant with him. You need not rebel. You need not oppose him any longer. You were made to worship God. And because of Jesus, you can be in right relationship with God today. That's what the enemy of God needs to hear. For the child of God, Exodus 24 is assurance, isn't it? Exodus 24 is assurance. The old covenant said, if you obey, you will live. The new covenant says, since Jesus obeyed, you will live. There is security for those in the new covenant because Jesus' work for us is finished and it is perfect. Oh, be assured today, Christian, assured of your salvation and your place at the table with God. Exodus 24 is the reason for evangelism. Covenant is the reason we tell others who God is. God is not a puzzle to solve. He is a loving God who beckons sinners to him and invites them into covenant. People need to know. Christian, who has struggled finding motivation or courage to witness to those around you, consider that God has extended his covenant mercies to the world, and you are to be the messenger. Covenant is the basis for worship. We worship God because he has brought his enemies into his presence and embraced them as family. What a good and loving God he is. This is why we sing. This is why we care for one another. This is why we take the Lord's Supper. This is why we tell others. This is why we raise our kids right. This is why we honor our parents even when we become parents. Because God has brought us near. May we see him as glorious today. Let's pray together.